The Continuing Adventures of Nick Guy, Data Detective. Tonight's episode, A Profile in Death. Last time, Nick Guy and Grant Patch, data producer for the recently deceased Consolidated Dynamics, were looking for Grant's coworker, Jennifer AI. Jennifer had sought out Nick's help and ended up stealing his car. Grant thought he knew where she was going.
Consolidated Dynamics was headquartered in a sprawling campus, the typical squat buildings encircling neatly manicured lawns. I'd been there in the daytime once, was familiar with the setup, the parking, and the geese. At night, the undersides of the low-hanging clouds glowed from the reflected light of too many fluorescent bulbs. We checked in with a guard at the gate. It didn't seem like he'd heard the news yet, but there were 100 parking spaces and no cars. We stopped in the fire lane in front of the building.
Come, this way.
We walked briskly through the front door, across the lobby, up the stairs, and into a cubicle farm, 6x6, each one, row after row. Repressed memories from another life sent a shudder up my spine. Try not to think about it.
My office is just ahead.
The door was ajar. Harsh fluorescent light escaped into the hallway. We stopped short, approached the door slowly, carefully. I pushed it open. Sitting behind the desk was Jennifer, holding a can of wasp spray.
Just in case it wasn't you, this is a gun-free zone. No pepper spray or mace either. Wasp spray is the best defense.
Instinctively, my hand went to my jacket pocket. It was empty. It was as though my revolver had evaporated. When they say gun-free, they mean it.
Nick, I know. Grant, I know. But you, I don't know.
Grant and I both spun quickly to see who was behind us, but there was no one else in the room or the hallway. Jennifer seemed to be seeing things.
You two sit. You will have to stand.
There were two chairs. I don't know who else she was talking to.
Now, listen.
Where's my car?
I parked it out back.
She looked angry. Her gaze darted between Grant and the empty corner of her office. I was confused, but frankly didn't care. I was just glad she wasn't looking at me. I've been looked at that way before, and I don't like it. She turned toward Grant.
I knew you'd come here. Back to the scene of the crime. Admiring your handiwork. Well, I'm not going to let you pin this one on me. My name might have been on that report, but you provided the source data. This is the end for you.
She started to stand up, raising the can of wasp spray still clutched in her hand. Wait. Why don't we go to the lab and look at the source data? Profile it. Get its lineage. Let's check the metadata.
Yes, let's.
I didn't think the wasp spray would do much damage, even if she did pull the trigger. But the way this night was going, I did not want to take any chances. Jennifer strode around the desk and out the door. She was halfway down the hall when she looked back over her shoulder.
Come on.
The three of us, or four, depending who was counting, wound our way to the other side of the building. We stood before a door labeled Lab. Jennifer swiped her card key through the adjacent reader and the latch clicked. She pushed the door open. We all stepped inside. Jennifer stepped to one of the terminals.
Right over here. Let me show you. I'm innocent.
Just then, three officers burst through the door.
Jennifer AI, you're under arrest for the murder of Consolidated Dynamics.
Is this the end for Jennifer? Who is this mysterious third visitor? Or is Jennifer just seeing things? And what about Grant, who just happened to show up at the murder scene? Tune in next time for the exciting conclusion of Nick Guy, Data Detective.
This is John Ladley.
And Mark Cooper. Welcome to the Rock Bottom Data Feed. Hey, Let's get on to the last part.
We can't. We have to wait till next time.
You mean this isn't like a streaming service series where you can binge watch the whole thing at once?
No. It's more like public access cable. They probably haven't even finished writing the last episode yet.
Oh, okay. Then I guess we should get on with the rest of the show.
Do you know what a principal is? Not the balding, life-worn guy in a cheap suit that was in the elementary school office. I mean principal with P-L-E spelling. Like, he has no principles. Well, I'll stay away from politics. We'll hear about that a lot these days. Anyway, companies brag about principle-centered leadership. A short definition comes from Stephen Covey's fine book called Principle-Centered Leadership. Principles are self-evident, self-validating, natural laws. Organizations often explore and adopt data principles, an extension of the principle-type thinking. Not all organizations do that, though. Most organizations just have policies, but no principles. And this actually creates a roadblock to better data management. Principles set forth the policy around something to the organization. If it is people, then it's about leading and inspiring people a certain way. Then people rally around the philosophy and unify. So you're not using fear as an incentive or as a management tool. You're using cooperation and willing behavior. A good data principle is the same way. The most common data principle is data is an asset, and we'll treat data like an asset. Now, it won't work if the CDO says, we'll treat data as an asset, but you do X, Y, and Z and L or else. The correct approach is to, of course, encourage people that treating data as an asset is for the better of everybody. People will embrace the implications of the principle. For example, if data is an asset, we need some controls in place. That minimizes resistance. But try and field a policy without a principle, and you don't have that thinking in the background, and you're going to get pushback. So if you believe that data is an asset, make it a principle. Leadership can then walk the talk. Management can then build that type of thinking into all of their other actions and other decisions. Leaders, ask the question, where are our data principles? Who wrote them? How are we going to roll them out? And be nice to each other. I am delighted to have as our guest on the Rock Bottom Data Feed today, a brilliant mind and a good friend and colleague, Dr. Malcolm Chisholm. Welcome to the Rock Bottom Data Feed, Malcolm.
Thank you for having me, John. And likewise, it's been great to be associated with you over the years in all these different ways. So thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, we never thought we would be actually trying to do something entertaining from our work here. Also with us today, of course, is Mark Cooper. Hello, Mark. How are you, sir?
I am excellent. Thank you very much.
All righty. So, Malcolm, you're on because A, you're brilliant. B, you just wrote a book that's kind of fits into what's going on in our data world right now. Tell us about your book and why you did it.
So the book is called Successful and Sustainable Data Policies. And I did it because I think that data governance, if we think about data governance as a profession or an organizational unit, has increasingly in recent years taken a turn towards the more technical with things like data catalogs, incorporation of concepts like data mesh, all of which are fine. But I think it's left a lack of emphasis on a core aspect of governance, which is policies. So if you think about it, you have a relatively tiny central data governance office in an organization. How can it govern or ensure that data is well managed across an entire enterprise if you're just a few people in one place? And one of the there's various ways to addressing that problem. One of them is policies. Policies are high-level documents that constrain business behavior, the way that people will interact with data. If you don't have that policies, I don't quite see how you are actually governing the data. And I think that can be a major gap for a number of data governance units. Hence, I thought it was time for the book.
You mentioned that the policies constrain business behavior. Does it constrain the technical behavior, application development behavior as well?
There are policies for everything. Mm-hmm. So one of the problems we have is that when you talk to more technical people about policies, I think it's low-level rules for access control or something like that. So there is a disconnect in the IT world of what we mean by policies. But IT too does have policies. They'll have policies in, you know, for like maybe a systems development lifecycle approach, something like that. This is the way we're going to do things, guys. It's not so much about it can't be about rules, because that's too low level for a policy. A policy is going to tell you what the outcome is that we need to produce, not how to get there. Because if you knew how to get there, well, you don't know how to get there in every possible circumstance, in every possible organizational unit. So it's going to be high level. So it tells you kind of what to do, but not how to do it. How to do it could be addressed by standards, procedures, or other things, but not policies. And then the point you raise really, I think, is, well, what's the scope of data policies from a data governance unit? That's super important. That has to be set, that scope, because otherwise you're going to get turf wars, and that's a problem. Or things will fall between the cracks if you go too narrow relative to other organizational units. So that's something that has to be addressed in policy work. So we're focusing on data policies that a data governance unit would reasonably be expected to have in place to assure good data management practices across an organization.
It sounded to me like for someone who is working on a policy, you know, I teach a basic data governance class, and when we cover policies, the question is, what's in it? How do I do one? What's in it? How do I do one? Can you show me an example? And it's probably the most copied example off the internet for data governance or policies, right? It sounded to me like you've thought about this, and there's kind of a what should be in one, what should be outside. There's a bit of a taxonomy here of what's in it, what's out. So can you describe where does policy start, where does policy end, and what's it bumping up against?
Right. So I think if you think about levels of things, the very highest level is going to be principles, which is what things we believe in, their statements, their absolute presuppositions. You either agree with them or you don't. You don't analyze them. You can't derive them. It's just kind of what our principles are for data governance, data management. Okay. If you've got those, then policies will be the next level down. And the policy is saying, okay, given these principles, this is what we believe, we're going to manage data in such and in these different ways. And you can have different policies for that, like data retention, data obfuscation, data privacy, and whatever, and so on. Okay, the policies will tell you, again, what to do. Now, the next level down would be standards. Now, standards also, they're not in the book or anything, but there's various interpretations in the world of what they are. For some people, they are practices that are prescribed to say, this is how we are actually going to do this to achieve what the policy tells us to do. Okay. Like, we have a data retention policy. We're going to force everybody in the business unit to choose a champion who will then decide what record types we have so we can find out what rules we need to then, dispose of the data after a certain period of time, whatever. So that's the standards level. Standards can also be things like, we're going to use newtons instead of foot pounds or something like that. We're going to use USD instead of EUR, units of measure that we're going to choose, things like that, where we standardize the actual data value. So it's a broad range, but policies sit between those two kind of extremes. Now, just to tackle something about the book, what I'm saying is that policies have to be successful and sustainable. In order to do that, they have to be institutionalized. It's not a question of writing a policy, because lots of people can put things down in a Word document and throw it onto SharePoint and say, we're done. Yeah, we have a policy. You don't. You have to go through an entire policy life cycle that has to be institutionalized, meaning that it's not subject to the whim of any individual person in any role at any one time. And that's a lot of what the book is about, the life cycle, the meta-governance, as it were, of policies.
So do you find that most companies start with an outcome? This is what they want their data to look like, or what they want to have at the end of it, and then back into the policies and principles? Do you find that many actually start with a set of principles and then march forward to wherever that leads, or both ends to the middle?
No, I think that most enterprises suffer from two issues. They don't have the principles. They're told, we need a policy, or we need policies. Okay, so they go write a policy. Okay, now we have the policy. And so they don't have the policy lifecycle processes in place, which I would say are like taking the request for the policy, formulating the policy, getting initial approval of the policy, doing policy harmonization, where you make sure what you've written in the policy doesn't contradict any other policy in the organization, data or non-data policies, policy promulgation, where you push the policy out and communicate it to the enterprise, and you also hook up with internal audit, whoever's going to check compliance, policy operationalization, where people are actually operationalizing it, the processing of variance requests where people can't operationalize it and request an exception for a period of time, any follow-ups in terms of compliance violations, annual policy reviews, and then policy discontinuation. That they don't have that in place in an institutionalized framework, so their policies fail because they're just documents, nothing more.
So in terms of failing, does that mean nobody does it, it's ignored, or are there other consequences that you've seen?
They're ignored. Typically, it's like, let's say if it's not promulgated, if it's not communicated, nobody knows about it. It's like, well, how do I find out about it? Well, you know, you should have gone to, you know, 10 levels deep in this SharePoint and it's there. Why didn't you read it? Well, nobody's going to do that. They're not supported either. So they'll fail because of that. They'll also fail if they're poorly written, if they're poorly formulated. You can see policies that are dozens of pages long, that are just giant blobs of text. So you might know about the policy and say, okay, I have this particular need. The policy, I think, addresses that. Now I have to read 28 pages or something like that of the policy, top to bottom, because it's written as a giant single blob of text, instead of the policy statements being atomic, individualized, and called out so I can quickly see them. That's another reason you'll get failure. And then you don't have those variance processes in place. So people say, well, I can't implement it, I can't operationalize it, so I'll ignore it. Whereas you were supposed to, if you had a variance in process in place, to say, yes, I can't operationalize it, I therefore have to request to be exempted for it for 3, 6, 12 months, whatever. And that's an official process. But without that process, I'm just going to ignore it. So there's all these kinds of reasons why things can go wrong. It needs to be a very robust sort of process and environment, and these things have to be extremely well written.
It seems to me that, you know, a lot can go wrong, and we all, and those of us that do this type of work, we just, you know, we're right working on policy and we're like, okay, how badly is this going to be ignored when we roll it out? Do you have a set of rules, Malcolm, or little tricks of the trade to make these things stick? Let's assume it's properly written. Let's assume it's really on point. It's a good, solid policy. We all know that's meaningless because it still tends to be ignored. Tell us what else you do to get it to stick. What else do you do to institutionalize it?
Right. So the promulgation phase, a lot of communication. Well, first of all, I think it's good for data governance units to have the mindset like, what would human resources do? What would risk do? What would finance do with their policies and start behaving like that? You want to ignore the finance policy? You want to ignore the HR policy? You'll get in a lot of trouble if you do that. Okay, so data governance needs to have a leadership position. These things are not optional or suggestions. If you're going to do policies, you've got to fully commit to them. So you need to communicate them well. And I think one of the things that I worry about with data governance unit is they don't have corporate communication capabilities. Now, you don't actually have to have them per se, because there might be a corporate communications function in your organization that you can use, okay? But you still need to engage them. So you need some kind of communications capability in a data governance unit. And to the extent people, you know, data governance units arise out of IT or have a more technical focus, they don't have that. And that's a massive mistake. So once you've got that, you've got to plan, you've got to have a promulgation plan where you plan out, okay, this is how we're going to communicate it. And you might do things like, you know, I mean, emails are saturated, but you may need to use them, banners on the corporate intranet. You've also got the champion type programs where if you have data stewards, you need to inform them first and get them to inform the folks in their areas about the policy that's coming. Keep beating the drum about it. Also go to internal audit and say, okay, here's this new policy. We expect you to, you know, when you're conducting your audits, to see if people are complying to it. Okay, you know, and inform us if there's any findings. So I think those are some of the things, but it's a long haul and the policies have to be supported. They're not written once and then we move on to the next project like day laborers. It's something that it's going to have to be sustained. And people will have questions about policies. They don't always understand what they're being told. They do have strange corner cases. So you have to be on call for that. So data governance must not think that it writes a policy and we're done. Everybody else just has to follow. No, you've got, for every policy you create, you're going to have an incremental support burden that you need to have resourced for. And that's important.
Now, I'm sure that there's not a fixed number of policies that a company should have, but it seems like it would be easy to overwhelm a population with policies. You know, here's these 100 things that you need to keep top of mind all the time. What have you found to be the sweet spot? And is there a hierarchy? These are the three most important policies that you need to keep in front of you all the time. Put it up on your cubicle wall and poster, whatever. And then these are the next set. This is the next set.
Right. So there is a hierarchy of sorts. So the first thing you need is a policy of policies. And some regulators will demand that, okay, in certain industries. What's the policy of policies? It says, okay, here's data governance. It's going to issue policies for data. Who's granting that authority? Well, let's document that. What is the scope in terms of, you know, the boundaries of what is a data policy and what's not? Because we don't want to, you know, go and like do enterprise architecture policies if we're data. So that's somebody else's responsibility. So that, and then, okay, what's your organizational structure, your institutional framework for doing this? Do you have a committee for this? Are you using a special committee? You're going to use a data governance committee? Is it some other thing? You know, and again, at this point, I think this is important. We don't want it to be the mercy or whim of whoever happens to be in charge of data governance at any point in time. There has to be some kind of committee structure that includes people from outside of data governance. So it can't be ignored in the future. And it's a serious thing where it's not going to be whim based. Okay. So that's our policies. Then under that, I think it's the pressing needs of, you know, what good data management involves today. So, I mean, I think you can come up with a list that would probably between up to about 20 max, okay, maybe 15 max. But it'll be things like data retention, data privacy, maybe data quality, and so on. If you start getting more than that, it's probably the case that you're getting into standards or procedure or something lower level, and they're not policies.
And it becomes difficult for people on the ground to keep track of all of that. You know, if you have 20 policies, that's going to explode into some number of procedures or requirements that rest on top of that. And next thing, I'm having to juggle, you know, 120 different things all at the same time related to, and I already don't want to do this data stuff, right? This is already something that I'm not excited about.
That's right. That's why we can't have too many policies, because people have to remember them. Again, ignorance of the law is no excuse, but still, I mean, you know, we can't overburden people. And the policies have to be well written and simple and short so that they can action them, and well supported so they're reminded about them. People don't need to be just informed once, they have to be reminded. So all of that is necessary in this, because you're right. If people get overwhelmed, they just won't follow the policies. They won't be able to.
Terrific. One more kind of general question here, Malcolm, then we're going to wrap up. What one solid thought would you want to leave with somebody who's in the throes of rolling out governance and in the context of your policy book?
Right. Think about this policy management process. And as part of that, think about incorporating or bringing in people from other areas who are important to you, like internal audit, risk, maybe legal, and so on, so they can weigh in on deliberations as policies are thought about, so that it's not just an internal data governance sort of inward looking thing. It really is an enterprise function that you're carrying out.
Very good. Very good. Okay. We ask everyone on the podcast here two questions, and we, so are very fair and across the board. So the first question that we ask everybody is, what person, alive or dead, related or not related, has been the most influential to you in your data career?
Aristotle.
Aristotle? Yeah. Oh, wow. Going all the way back to the unmoved mover.
Yeah. Here,
there you go.
Yeah. Because, Aristotle. I mean, we do stuff based on logic. So he had taxonomies. He was actually a zoologist too. And as am I, and by, you know, university degree. So logic, analytics, prior analytics, posterior analytics, metaphysics, all of the good stuff started with him. And it's come all the way down to us.
You win the award for the most profound influential person since we started the pod a year and a half ago. So our second question we ask everybody, and this can be just a short answer type thing, is you inherit a magic wand and you can tap something and think hard and make any change that you want to make in this world of data, in the topic of data. What would your magic spell do?
My magic spell would be to make people who work in data governance think more like the corporate functions or the horizontal functions, whatever you want to call them, like human resources, finance, risk, rather than in that business sense, and have that very responsible attitude, rather than thinking of themselves as being some kind of more technical administrative types.
Very good. Very good. Thank you, Malcolm Chisholm, Dr. Malcolm Chisholm. Malcolm will be back here in a few minutes on the pod for our game show. But thanks for your time, sir. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise, thank you for the invitation. It's been fun.
And thanks to our sponsor, Hubris Data Pros. When you can't get anyone to support your data governance efforts, let Hubris be your last resort. Hubris Data Pros.
Welcome to Dispatches from Rock Bottom, dredging up practical information, advice, and food for thought. It's a bit of a paradox. At a time when we have increasing access to interpretive resources like ChatGPT, it's becoming increasingly important that we do our own research and form our own opinions. The risk of confirmation bias is overwhelming. If you want ChatGPT to support your existing viewpoint, it will, probably without even asking. On June 6th, a TikTok user posted a video where she read the ChatGPT analysis of H.R. 1, also known as the Big Beautiful Bill here in the United States. In 5 days, the video had been viewed over 2 million times. Curious, I ran the experiment myself, loading the full text of the bill into ChatGPT and asking the same question she asked. That led to a weekend going down the rabbit hole of probing my prompts and cataloging ChatGPT's responses. Turns out, my experience was consistent with recent research examining bias in large language models, including a 2025 Stanford University study that had two significant findings. The first was that users overwhelmingly perceive that most popular LLMs have a left-leaning political bias, and that doesn't come as a surprise. But the second was that LLMs can be prompted to take a more neutral stance by simply asking for it. I tried it, and that's exactly what happened. Finally, I asked ChatGPT to comment on the prompt in the video. What are your thoughts on this bill altogether? Really give it to me. Don't hold anything back. It replied that on the surface, it's a call for unfiltered honesty and maximum clarity, but underneath the surface, it seeks a response that leans toward the user's own beliefs. In other words, it was an invitation for ChatGPT to interpret the user's bias and then respond in a way consistent with that interpretation. So between now and next time, the one thing you can do is to explicitly demand objectiveness in your ChatGPT prompts. Gen AI should be the first word, not the last word. That's what I think. We'd love to hear your stories if you're willing to share. Write us at rockbottom@counterthreadedproductions.com.
We're going to welcome Malcolm Chisholm back to the pod here for just a few moments for our not-so-famous game show. Welcome back, Malcolm. Are you ready to play?
Yes.
All right. I would like you to pick a number between 1 and 4. I will select a song based on that number. And then I would like you to tell me the data management emotion that that music evokes. That's kind of...
Is that an oxymoron?
I was going to say that's a sad state of human existence if you have data management emotions. But whatever it evokes in the context of our conversations here, please... just let it out. Kind of, we call it the audio Rorschach test. Okay, so whatever comes to mind, just let it rip. Are you ready, sir? Pick a number between 1 and 4.
1.
Number 1. Here we go. Thoughts, impressions?
The impression is receiving messages or notifications of poor data quality.
Kind of adds to a little tension.
Yes.
A little concern.
Yes.
A little melancholy, maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. I just wanted to use the word melancholy
panic.
Today.
Panic.
Panic. Very good. That's the game show. Wasn't that just beyond any realm of excitement you've ever experienced, Malcolm?
You win.
Yeah, you win. You get a fabulous prize. We don't know what it is yet, and we have no budget. Okay. But whenever we come up with it, we'll send you something. Of course, you'll have the all of our guests do get the home version of the Rock Bottom Data Feed game to play when enough we ever invent that too. So.
Oh, thank you.
Malcolm, once again, thanks so much, and thanks for being on the Rock Bottom Data Feed.
Thank you for the invite, and thanks very much for being such great hosts, John and Mark. I enjoyed it very much.
And thanks again to our sponsor, Hubris Data Pros, reminding you that any resemblance to actual events, persons, or businesses, living or dead, is purely coincidental. How well do you know your organization's data policies and the principles in which they're rooted? Are they well-defined, like Malcolm described? Are they actionable? Are they well-known? Or are they shelfware or slideware, or maybe just still vaporware? Maybe there's an action item in there somewhere. And be sure to join us next time for the exciting conclusion of Nick Guy, Data Detective.
Until then, this has been John Ladley and Mark Cooper for the Rock Bottom Data Feed. Thanks for listening, and remember, when you're here, you've reached rock bottom. You can find more information about the topics covered in this episode, the fuss about principles and policies, at our website, rockbottomdatafeed.com. The Rock Bottom Data Feed is a counter-threaded production, copyright 2025, all rights reserved.